listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. So what are the advantages to hitting a mental rut? Could there be some? Why do ideas occur to us out of the blue while we're wandering down a cobblestone street in Lithuania, rather than when we're staring at the computer screen in our cubicle? That one seems pretty clear to me. Why are the young frequently more innovative than their elders? Is that true? Why did Steve Jobs think that the best meetings happen by accident in the hallway or the parking lot? What happens if we connect our imaginations together? What is the power of collaboration? How do we encourage the collision of creative people? Well, Joan Allaire has thought a lot about these issues and others related to the ideas that are how ideas are generated. And he's had the opportunity, taken the opportunity, to talk to a lot of creative people, from scientists to filmmakers to comedians, from jazz improvisers to the renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And the result is the very beautiful book, Imagine, How Creativity Works, a narrative of insightful stories about neuroscience and the creative process. And as it turns out, and as many of you here probably already know, creativity is not reserved just for artists and scientists, for special gifted people. It's an inherent part of the human brain. Joan Allaire shares his own insights on the brain and much more as a contributing editor at Wired and as a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. I was just listening to him talk about his new piece for The New Yorker, which is fascinating, and he needs to make that deadline. Joan grew up in Los Angeles. He attended LAUSD schools. He went on to Columbia, graduated with a degree in neuroscience, then studied at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, where he received his MA in 20th century literature and philosophy. He writes the Headcase column for the Wall Street Journal and regularly appears on WNYC's Radiolab. His writing, I'm sure you've read it, in Nature, the New York Times Magazine, Scientific American, and Outside, and he's the author of two previous books, Proust Was a Neuroscience and How We Decide. We're very honored to have in conversation with Jonah tonight Dr. Michael Quick, who's both professor of biological sciences and the executive vice provost at the University of Southern California. He's known at USC for his passion for neuroscience, for inspiring his students, and for his compelling lectures. He also programs the First Fridays over at the American, at the Natural History Museum on Exposition Boulevard. His own scholarship focuses on how drugs of abuse, such as cocaine and nicotine, and therapeutic drugs, such as antidepressants and anti-epileptic medications, alter the signaling properties of nerve cells. And with that, please join me in welcoming Joan Allaire and Dr. Michael Quick. Thank you.
Oh, what a good crowd. Hi, how's everybody? Good to see you all. This is terrific. Jonah, thanks for getting dressed up for me. I appreciate that. You know, I really do want to. I was going to save this for the end, sort of to, you know, find out how many of you often come to the Aloud series. Hands up. Oh, that's great. So you guys know how important it's been for the last couple of decades, and anything you can do to support the Aloud program and the foundation, you know, this is just a Los Angeles, you know, icon. And I think, you know, it's just worth supporting in any way that you can. And I wanted to say that now because probably our conversation will make you feel like maybe you don't want to support it. So I thought I would get that out of the way. Actually, first. So I'm wearing my blue tie because I read that blue is the creative color. So I just wanted you to know that.
Thank you.
You know, I think maybe, you know, why don't we start? We'll end up at the book, but let's start a little bit back from the book, which is, you know, you worked in Eric Kandel's lab when you were at Columbia. Were you already, you know, did you already love the brain and that drew you to Eric's lab? Or did you kind of learn to love the brain from Eric's lab?
You don't study a lot of brains in Eric Kendall's lab.
Yeah,
you study lots of aplasia, central nervous system, so it's a sea slug. So it was definitely the love of the brain that drew me to Eric's lab. Just here was a guy who really pioneered the reductionist approach, who's, you know, what he won the Nobel for is not any specific fact, but just an idea about how we can gather those facts about the way the mind works. And so he pioneered a process about dissecting, deconstructing memories by basically studying how quickly a sea slug will get bored when you poke it again and again and again, realizing that process of boredom, habituation, is in a sense a form of long-term memory.
Right.
And so then you can study the chemistry of how those neurons embody those memories. So it was very much an interest in those really grand questions. What is memory? How do our memories persist? What is the mind? And I was, of course, the cliched portrait of a naive undergraduate just in love with thinking about these big ideas. And then, of course, you're thrown into the manual labor of a lab where you're wearing latex gloves and you're not thinking about big, grand questions at all. You're just trying to make your PCRs work. And mine never worked. I excelled at experimental failure. But it was an incredible privilege to get to spend several years in that lab, just getting to spend time with great scientists, learning how difficult science is, just what it's like to negotiate with reality.
Yeah, there's nothing like failed experiments to get you to think about, maybe I'll write about science, rather than actually...
there is something daunting, and the postdoc I was working for, he warned me from day one. He said, his failure rate was about 75%. Mine was closer to 99%. But he was very indulgent to me and very supportive. But it was after several years in the lab, I just realized I wasn't cut out for it. I didn't have the discipline for it. I didn't have the patience for it. And so eventually that put me on this winding road, which led back to science writing. Because I realized after I tried to leave science behind, because I sucked at it, I realized I missed it. I missed empiricism. I missed talking about facts. I missed feeling facts change and feeling people trying to understand new things.
Yeah.
The optimism of science, I missed.
Right. So, I'm gonna say one nice thing to you, and then I'm gonna stop because you're actually such a nice guy. I hate you, but so I think one of the nicest compliments I could possibly throw out to you actually had to do with your first book. Proust was a neuroscientist, because I remember when it came out, a lot of us, I'm a neuroscientist, a lot of my colleagues were reading the book. And as most scientists will do, they dismiss everything that gets written, and this is crap. But what I found was really interesting is we would keep talking about it, and we kept talking about it, and pretty soon we realized we were spending all of our time talking about the book you had written.
That means a tremendous amount.
And we did the same thing with your second book, How We Decide, because you were an idiot about that book too. And then the next thing we knew, we were really amazed at really kind of the insights and things that come from this. And so I just want to give you a shout out, because your books on neuroscience really are some of the best that even scientists think.
That's great.
So let's move on.
If I can fly to you right back. Just one thing I still struggle with as a science writer, having been exposed to the rigors and the struggles of the scientific process, is I always think of this great W.H. Auden line about when he's in a room full of scientists, feels like a shabby curate in a room full of dukes. I think one of the things I struggle with as a science writer is this slight feeling of being a parasite. I know how hard it is to come up with new facts and invent new acronyms. And you'll spend, I'll spend a week with someone who has spent 40 years studying a synaptic protein.
Right.
And you look at that kind of dedication, that kind of grit, that kind of persistence, and, you're kind of in awe. So I know that makes my job possible. It's being the translator is the easy part.
Yeah.
Finding the facts to translate is the hard part.
Yeah. Well, I got into the business for the acronyms and for the groupies, and so it's been absolutely great for all that time. So I have a number of very important questions, but I want to start with: do you actually own a Swiffer?
I have the whole family in my closet.
Do you really?
The duster, kind of the wet mop, the dry mop. I'm a big fan of the Swiffer.
Why? Tell me about it.
I should probably begin where I first heard the Swiffer story. It was at a marketing conference, not a particularly exciting thing, and I was backstage and making small talk with one of the speakers, and I was saying, so what do you work on? And the guy says, I work on floor cleaning. And my first response, of course, is, oh, God, floor cleaning is going to be a scintillating conversation. And then he tells me the story of how he invented the Swiffer, which is I think, a pretty fun story. It began when Procter & Gamble had been trying for the last 3 years, and Procter & Gamble at the time had more PhDs on staff than any other company in the world. They were an innovation powerhouse. And so they had assigned a team of chemists to come up with a new line of soaps for their mops. So these chemists had struggled for several years to come up with a new line of soaps because it turns out you make soap stronger and you peel the varnish off wood floors, you irritate delicate skin. Coming up with a stronger soap is a very hard chemistry problem. So eventually the executives got fed up with these 30 chemists who couldn't give them a good solution that they could take to market. So they outsourced the problem to this design firm called Continuum. Continuum spends 9 months watching people mop the floor.
That's exciting.
Yeah, no. And they videotape everything, and I've watched these videotapes. The videotapes are even more boring than you think they are. But what they discover after 9 months of watching people mop is that mopping is a terrible idea. That you spend more time cleaning your mop than you do cleaning the actual floor. And that's because companies like Procter & Gamble had come up with all these new mop fibers that were great at getting dirt off the floor. But that meant it was very tough to get the dirt out of the mop head. You know, and so you watch these poor people try to get the dirt out of their mop head in these narrow bathtubs, and they never really succeed, so they end up splashing dirty water all over the floor. And after 9 months of watching this, you realize that mopping is a failed technology. That is an everyday chore that makes no sense. And so then the guys go back to Procter & Gamble and say, we haven't solved your problem, we just realized that it's actually much worse than you think. P&G, of course, isn't thrilled with that answer. They give them another month to come up with a solution. So they return in desperation to the site visits. And one interesting detail about these kinds of site visits is you have to be a little mischievous, because when you tell people we're coming to watch you clean your house, what they do is they clean their house before you get there.
Right.
So what these designers had gotten in the bad habit of is they'd actually bring coffee grinds with them and spill them surreptitiously on the floor when these people weren't looking. And so they're in this house with this elderly lady, and they're spilling coffee all over her kitchen. And even though she said in the pre-interview that she always mopped and always vacuumed, she didn't clean up these coffee grinds with a mop or a vacuum. Instead, she just tore off a paper towel, wet the paper towel, and ran along the floor. And this is something that the designers of Continuum, of course, had done thousands of times before. Yet when they watched her do it, coupled with this new knowledge of mopping being a failed technology, they suddenly had their big moment of insight, their epiphany. And that's when they came up with the idea of the Swiffer, which is, of course, just the pole of a mop with a disposable wipe. Right. And it's a product P&G loves because it performs well in the cleaning tests, but it also means you get to charge $10
stuff,
for basically six paper towels.
If that's not the definition of creativity, yeah, I don't know
exactly
what it is. But along those lines, I mean, do you have one? I mean, is creativity the pornography definition?
Yeah, you know when you see it.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, I mean, this is something, when I was beginning the book, I thought a lot about, like, the hermeneutics of creativity. In the end, I realized it is just, you know it when you see it, that you can spend a lifetime debating. You know, creativity, in essence, is a new idea that other people find useful. Right? That's as simple and spare as one can get in defining creativity. And then you can spend the rest of your life debating the definition of new and the definition of useful and on down the line. And in the end, I just realized this wasn't one of the intellectual issues I was interested in about creativity. That I was happy with that definition. And I certainly had a sense that it is one of those things. You know it when you see it. We've got a pretty good ability, I think, to figure out, you know, where it's simple theft, where someone's just stealing an idea, and when they're doing enough to that idea to make it new, to make it their own. Because in the end, you know, creativity is just a new connection between old ideas.
Right.
So it's a recombination, it's a mashup. So it's always a delicate line. I mean, I love this Bob Dylan line about, he describes his creative process, one is love and theft. You fall in love and then you steal it. But that does raise the issue of exactly where theft becomes creativity and when it's just theft. And that's something I think it's very tough to come up with firm guidelines.
Yeah.
It's just something you know it when you see it.
Well, how do you think about it relative to other words that we use, that we overuse, like insight or innovation? Yeah. Or, I mean, do you kind of think about those things as all the same thing? Or
yeah, I mean, I think they're all synonyms. I mean, I think moments of insight are actually a pretty well-defined psychological phenomenon. So cognitive scientists have done a really good job over the last few decades coming up with good definitions of defining moments of insight. And they're a particular phenomenon, and they've got a particular brain signature. So that, I think, is pretty well defined at a number of levels. In terms of creativity, innovation, these are synonyms. They're buzzwords. And in general, I don't get too interested in the precise semantics of what's creativity and what's innovation and how we define the two.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been wearing this tie for about since I read your book. And
it
frankly has not helped. I'm all about the thievery part.
Yeah.
Of your definition, the other part I'm not good at. So there are some people who are just, you know, it's a nature nurture thing, right? I mean, there are just going to be some creative people, and because you spend a lot of time talking about ways we can actually sort of increase our creativity, but there are people who just have that innately, right?
Creativity is like any other human talent. It's a bell curve. So some people are going to have a bit more of it than the rest of us. But I think the mistake we've made in thinking about creativity for thousands of years is we've assumed it's an all or nothing phenomenon. That you either have it, in which case you're a creative type, or you don't, which case you're like the rest of us and you're reduced to repeating the work of others. And you see this in some very sad polling literature, survey literature on kids in K-12 education, where every second grader believes they're creative. And then by fourth grade, it's down to about 50%. By the time they're in middle school, it's in the low 20s. By the time they're seniors in high school, it's in single digits.
Yeah, so that's why we really keep them there for 12 years. Yeah, out of them completely, I think, is the whole
thing. But you do see over the course of 12 years of education, they come to believe that creativity is this rare gift, that some people have access to the muses, and the rest of us don't. And that is not what the science says. The science, I think, is clear that, of course, you know, this is a talent, and some people are going to have more of it.
Right.
But it is a universal human talent.
Yeah.
It's something we all have at least a little bit of, and that means we can all get better at it. And just to bring that back to Blue, not to quibble, but that is, the shade is a little off. It's a bit
more
of a... That's the problem. It's a bit more of a kind of a powder blue.
You should have specified
blue then. If only they printed my book in color.
My lawyers would be in touch.
But so this is this clever study, came out in Science in 2009 by research at the University of British Columbia, where it was a huge sample size, 650 undergrads. Simple experiment. They gave them a battery of cognitive tests. Some people in red rooms, some people in blue rooms. Just exposed them to these colors. People in red rooms were better at things like copy editing, long division, things that require more analytical skills. And that's because red makes us think of, you know, stop signs and danger and blood. And so we're more vigilant, we're more attentive. When they put people in these powder blue rooms, it turns out they scored twice as high on tests, creative tests that require moments of insight. So you literally doubled the output of their imagination by just putting them in a differently colored room. And that's because blue makes us think of the ocean, the sky. We're a little bit more relaxed. We think in more abstract associations. That makes it easier to solve problems. But the real message of that study for me is less about, you know, the cognitive impact of colors than it is about, here's this thing which we assume is this innate trait that you either have it or you don't. And you can put people in a room that's a different color and you can double it. So it does suggest that our place in the bell curve isn't quite as fixed as we long assumed.
Yeah. So, did you come across... How creative are pigeons?
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time as scientists looking at a lot of these different creatures, and we often think about, you know, what are the uniquely human or semi-uniquely human traits? I don't think there are any unique ones, and we keep trying to think of them. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking, man, does this get us as close as we can to a uniquely human kind of trait?
Dan Gilbert has a great, he's a psychologist at Harvard, he's got a great line. He said, the curse of every psychologist is the temptation to one day begin a talk, I have found the uniquely human trait, and this is X, Y, and Z. And we've never actually found one, simply because that's not the way biology works.
Right.
Natural selection doesn't all of a sudden have these moments of insight where it endows people with an imagination module. That said, I think the imagination, I think, you know, even just a trait as humble as the ability to invent a metaphor, a creative skill we all take for granted, we all do all the time, it's hard to find too many precursors that closely resemble that. And then, of course, there's the fact that we live in a world of our own inventions. We live surrounded by things we invented out of thin air. And not too many other animals, not too many other species do that. One of my favorite ways to illustrate just how unique human creativity is. This comes from the work of Jeffrey West, who's probably best known for data mining cities, but he's got this great back of the envelope calculation where he points out, you know, A human animal at rest requires 90 watts to just power the body. Look at a hunter-gatherer society. To maintain their lifestyle, about 250 watts per day. Then you ask yourself, well, how many watts does it take to power 21st century lifestyle of a typical American? Mm-hmm. You know, to fuel all, you know, to fuel our cars, to fuel our gadgets, to make the iPad, to make these clothes. And the answer is 11,000 watts. So we live in a world of our intervention that's a world that's very expensive to maintain. You can ask yourself, well, what kind of animal requires 11,000 watts to just fuel the body? And it turns out it's two blue whales. And then it makes it clear just our creativity has come with the cost. We've built these very unsustainable lives because there's no way the world can sustain 7 billion blue whales. But it does capture the fact that we built these lifestyles which are so expensive to maintain. And just kind of, you know, they're off the charts of biology. So the imagination certainly has precursors, but what the imagination has enabled, I don't think has a precursor.
Yeah, okay. But being a scientist and...
Yeah. Crow's problem solved, for sure.
That's true. Not the most optimistic of scientists. I always look for the bad in everything.
Yeah.
So, and you started to hint about it a little bit. I mean, there are downsides to creativity, right? I mean, not only the... You know, the sort of...
The looming environmental disaster. You want worse than that?
Yeah, I do want worse than that. Well, I was just trying to think about... I've reached a point in my life where I'm now saying things like, in the good old days, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like every year now, there's an upheaval because somebody was freaking creative.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe 20 years ago... There was one every couple of years, and maybe 100 years ago there was one every decade. It seems like now we are just in these revolution modes in terms of the way creativity has driven us to see things. I think that's a horrible thing, Jonah. We just need to get back to horse and buggy. That was as good as it was going to get.
I think we are on the treadmill, and the treadmill is getting faster. And Jeffrey West has also got these back-of-the-envelope calculations that hinted that, because what you find that when you live a lifestyle as expensive as ours is you deplete resources at a much faster rate. So, you know, you deplete coal, and you got to find a new thing to fuel coal, and you deplete silicone, and you got to find a new thing to replace that, and lithium you exhaust. So because our lifestyle is so expensive, we're exhausting these resources at a very, very fast clip, and that means we constantly have to reinvent ourselves. We constantly have to find new ways to make this unsustainable lifestyle sustainable, at least for another few years.
Yeah.
So there is a sense at which our creativity is causing revolutions to increase, and he's got this interesting chart where he shows that the second half of the 20th century, for the first time, people experienced multiple revolutions within a single life. So before, you'd have one revolution in your life, and that was it. You could adjust to it. But now we're getting it about every 15, 20 years. So there is a real sense, I think, that the pace of change is changing, and the pace of change is getting faster. That said, I think the only solution to human innovation is more human innovation.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think the paradox of creativity is it's put us in this pickle, but the only solution for it is human creativity.
Yeah. Wow. That's really upbeat. okay. So I've been dying to get into the sort of the brain about this stuff. So. I think when I talk to my students about the brain, I always have to remind them the part where they're actually doing conscious thought is such a small piece of everything that the brain is doing, and they hate hearing that because they like to think that they're rational creatures and all that kind of stuff. And you can talk to them about how their emotions drive so much of their decision making and all of these kinds of things. But it's the same in this sort of situation as well, right? I mean, we have so much of unconscious processing is going into creativity. Mm. It's, you know, who's doing the best job of mining that territory and figuring out, our unconscious processing that's underlying creativity.
I mean, that's one of the things that really drew me to the subject is just you can talk to people who have these epiphanies in the shower and you say, well, how did that happen? How did you engineer that? And they're as befuddled as the rest of us. Right. They have no idea. They can't trace the archaeology of their thoughts. They have no idea where their best ideas come from. And so it really was this mystery of the unconscious, the fact that the unconscious is just sharing one of its secrets every once in a while that drew me to the question. And some of the researchers I profile in the book are Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Kunios at Drexel. And they were interested in studying moments of insight. Beeman comes from this problem by, he's got a longstanding history in studying patients with damage to the right hemisphere. And for a long time, neurologists dismissed these patients as saying they're mostly fine, you know, because damage to the left hemisphere, you suffer a lesion to the left hemisphere, and it's obvious. You have language problems, memory problems, problems paying attention. The right hemisphere, the deficits are much more subtle. So it's stuff like you often have difficulty understanding jokes, difficulty decoding metaphors, understanding poetry. So they're deficits which don't appear obvious on standard exams. But Beeman had spent about a decade really quantifying these deficits, trying to find ways to, you know, to make them more concrete. And that's eventually led him to Moments of Insight. And when they began studying Moments of Insight, they were faced with the obvious problem, which is how do you study these things from the perspective of the brain? Because you can't just put undergrads in a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany, we're ready for you.
Right.
That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, they had to come up with a set of word problems that generate lots of moments of insight on the fly. And the set of word problems they pioneered are called compound remote associate problems. The acronym is a bit unfortunate, CRAP. But basically what you do is you give people three words and they have to find a fourth word that can form a compound word with those three. It's stuff like, you know, a sample one is pine, crab, and sauce. The answer is apple, pineapple, crab, apple, applesauce.
I knew that.
Yeah. And if apple pops into your head, it almost always comes in a moment of insight. Another one, if you guys want to take a shot at it, age, mile, and sand.
Apple.
Apple. Stone, yes. So if it happened that quick, you almost certainly had an insight. Stone age, milestone, sandstone. And so you give people these compound remote associate problems in a brain scanner and a fancy fMRI machine, and you can begin to find the spikes in activity in the seconds before an insight appears. And one brain area that they've really pulled out from their various studies is a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus. It's an obscure bit of cortex in the back of the right hemisphere, just behind your ear. And had been previously associated with things like the interpretation of metaphors and the processing of jokes. And the reason it seems to be involved in all these things, Beeman and Kunios argue, is because when you understand a metaphor, when you're trying to make sense of Romeo saying that Juliet is the sun, you know, you can make sense of that metaphor by seeing what Juliet and suns have literally in common, because they have nothing in common, and Romeo isn't saying that Juliet's a big flaming ball of gas. Exactly. So instead you have to look for the underlying connections, that set of remote associations they actually share. And so you realize Shakespeare's saying that Juliet lights up Romeo's world the way the sun lights up ours. Now, when you're trying to make sense of pine, crab, and sauce, it's a similar mental talent. You have to look past the fact that pine, crab, and sauce have nothing in common. You probably never used them in a sentence together before. Yet there's this one other word, which in this case is apple, which binds them together. Now, when you need a really big, radical new idea, when you're faced with a problem that seems impossible, you've hit the wall, this is also a brain area which there's a good shot it's going to play a big role in generating that moment of insight, because it's able to find the remote connection, that remote association between ideas that seemingly have nothing in common.
Yeah. So what I find interesting, I don't know if it's here, I'm sure it was in your previous book on decision making, is what illustrates this unconsciousness is the fact that you can see the aha moment coming before the person has a conscious awareness that they're going to have the aha moment.
So fMRI is a pretty bad temporal resolution. Yeah. So to get a good sense of the time scale of these mental events, they use EEG, which is like wearing a bulky shower cap, electrodes all over your scalp, and you got to grease up your hair. It's not my favorite neuroscience technique to be a guinea pig
for. But you don't do that with your hair now? I just
came from the lab, so that's my mess. But what Beeman and Kunios found in conjunction with guys at the University College of London was that they could predict up to 8 seconds in advance whether or not someone was going to have a moment of insight. So they could look at your EEG waves and they could say, sorry, buddy.
There's got to be a way to make money on that, right?
you just imagine the temptation to look at these poor undergraduates struggling with these compound and just be like, you're wasting your time. Go home. Never going to happen for you today. Or you could say, you know what, in about 7.5 seconds, brace yourself, because chances are looking pretty good. You're going to have an epiphany. The predictive signal is something called alpha waves. Like most things in the mind, alpha waves are very mysterious, but they are closely associated with states of relaxation. So, it's taking a walk on the beach, it's taking a hot shower, it's lying on the bed, getting ready for a nap, sitting on the couch with a beer, watching your favorite TV show, whatever it is that puts you at ease and makes you forget about work, chances are you've got lots of alpha wave production. Now, the reason these states of relaxation are so important, Beeman and Kunios argue, is that when you're not relaxed, when you're in basically the equivalent of a red room, you're very focused on the problem. So you're thinking about pine crab and sauce, and maybe there's a wrong answer, a common wrong answer is tree, that you just can't get past. And so that's where your attention is. It's consumed by the noise of the world. Not until you're relaxed in the shower, being pelted by hot water, it's soothing, it's relaxing, you're shampooing your hair, you start to daydream because you can't take your phone in the shower, so you have no email to check. And that's when at long last you turn that spotlight of attention inwards and hear that quiet voice coming from the unconscious, coming from this, you know, the rear parts of the right hemisphere saying, the answer is apple. The answer is maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or weeks. You just haven't taken a moment to listen.
What I really find interesting, though, along with that, this is somewhat related, and I don't know how much you've been able to find out about, but we're also really good, though, at knowing when we are not going to solve that.
Yeah.
Even with insider, and we just know I am out of my league. So yeah. We don't know what the answer is, but we yeah. know we're not going to get the answer,
yeah.
which I think is pretty insightful there.
No, I mean, you know, I'm fascinated with those aspects of cognition. I mean, they're called metacognition.
Right.
It's thoughts about thinking. And there's this wonderfully evocative phrase that psychologists have come up with for such intuitions, hunches about our own knowledge called feelings of knowing. And probably the classic example of feeling of knowing is when it works on the tip of your tongue.
Yeah.
You know, you walk down the street, you see someone, you know their name, but you just can't quite place it. It's so annoying, it drives me crazy. Yet it's also kind of profound because how do you know something
right,
if you don't actually know it?
Yeah.
I mean, it is totally mysterious. Why are you so convinced it's somewhere in one of these file cabinets if you can't actually find that memory? Well, this is where feelings of knowing prove essential. Now, what people like Janet Metcalf at Columbia found is that feelings of knowing are actually remarkably accurate guides when you give people various creative problems. That people can glance at a creative problem and say, nope, no way I can solve that in the given time frame. Or they can say, yeah, I can probably do that. That's probably within my grasp. Now, what makes these feelings of knowing even more useful, they come attached with a sense of progress. So even though, you know, people are working on a problem, they have no idea what the answer is. They have this vague hunch that they can find the answer eventually, but they're able to say whether or not they're getting closer to the answer. It is totally mysterious, because
yeah.
how do you know you're getting closer if you have no idea what the answer is?
Right.
And yet these feelings of knowing are really, really accurate, depending on the exact type of problem, between 80 and 95% accuracy. Mm. That people say, I can solve that within this time frame, yes siree. So this does set up, I think, this set of diagnostic tools we can give ourselves that when you've got a feeling of knowing, when you're thinking to yourself, I can tackle this problem, I got the sense of progress, I'm getting closer to the answer, then keep on chugging coffee. Keep on putting in the work, chain yourself to your desk, because the way you're going to solve it is through attention and grit and sheer persistence. But as soon as that feeling of knowing disappears, as soon as the problem starts to feel impossible, that's when you need a long hot shower. That's when you need to get those alpha waves going and find a way to relax. That's when you need to, you know, in a sense, turn your attention inwards and just stop paying attention to the world. That's why, you know, scientists have found that things that increase performance on problems that require moments of insight are things like getting undergrads legally drunk. Paper came out last month. You get undergrads legally drunk, they solve 30% more inside problems.
What if you get them? What if you get them illegally drunk?
What?
How's their solution if you get them illegally drunk?
I mean, the point of their study was just, it's not one beer, two beers. It is several
hammered.
And they solve 30% more. I mean, you can look at, you know, this really tough category of inside problems. People with severe brain damage to the frontal lobe. So they have a real tough time regulating attention. They often can't pay attention for more than 5 or 10 seconds at a time. So, you know, it's a real disability.
Yeah.
And yet their performance is often twice that of people without brain damage on these very difficult insight problems. Simply because not being able to pay attention
is actually helpful.
It keeps you thinking outside the box. It keeps you searching the idea space. And that's where you're more likely to find the solution, the far-fetched solution, that remote association you actually need.
So the... another phrase would be that somehow like concentration actually inhibits these creativity pathways are.
Yeah.
Somehow they get shut down when I'm in my red room focusing like crazy.
Yeah, and we live in an age which is obsessed with focus. You know,
right.
We diagnose 20% of kids with attention deficit disorders. We assume the way to solve a problem is to devote attention to it. And in many cases, that's a really good approach. If you've got a feeling of knowing, you know, taking a shower won't get you the answer. Yeah. You should invest in attention. You should drink caffeine. You should find a way to focus. But a lot of our hardest problems are those problems where we hit the wall, where we feel like this problem is impossible. I have no idea how to solve it. Right. Where the feeling of knowing has vanished. And in those cases, you have to have the confidence to go take a hike, to find a way to relax yourself. You know, Einstein has this great line that creativity is the residue of time wasted. And you know, I think if you're working on really hard problems that require moments of insight, you have to make time to waste time.
Yeah. So you'd be like the perfect boss, right? Because now what I've learned is I shouldn't concentrate. I should go take showers. I should get drunk.
Yeah. Marijuana works too.
I would not know.
Menu of drug options.
But it really, like you say, it really rubs against at least most of sort of the culture of the business world or things where you chain people to their desk and, you know, they work.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm guilty of that in my own lab. I mean, you know, people, you know, I'm going to go paint my lab red, actually, and get people to actually get some damn work done. But, you know, but there have been these few examples of, you know, and that you bring up in the book and in other places where allowing that to happen has really fundamentally changed the way a corporation runs.
Yeah. Right? You know, and it's got lessons for the classroom. So one of the first things we teach our kids in second grade is don't daydream. Stop looking out the window. Well, it turns out that people who daydream more score much higher on tests of creativity. The daydreaming mind wandering is an incredibly productive creative state. That you're mashing together new associations, exploring counterfactuals. It's actually quite useful. So I do think we have to expand our definition of what productive thinking looks like, that it's not always about focus. And I do think there are, you know, companies which a big part of their success is entangled with this expanded notion of what productivity looks like. The company I focus on in the book, in terms of this lesson, is 3M, which is, you know, a company that's not on the sexiest innovative companies of America list, but it has an amazing track record of creativity. That it was a sandpaper company in the 1930s, and then they invented tape. You know, not one kind of tape, just the idea of tape. Then Scotch tape.
And that's not sexy? Come on.
No. Then Post-it notes, but they've got 50,000 employees and 50,000 products. That now they're working on, you know, drug delivery. They make the glue that holds together your iPhone. They've helped solve the battery problem in laptops. I sound like an infomercial for them. I apologize. But I do think they've got an interesting track record because they're not a flash in the pan. They've been doing this for a long time. And one of the things that they really credit with their success is what they call the 15% rule, which most people now associate with Google, but Google just took it from 3M. They developed this in the 1960s, and people said they're crazy. But the rule goes like this. They tell every scientist, we'll give you 15% of your workday to work on whatever you want, to just manage your time however you see fit. If you want to work on a side project, go for it. If you want to take a nap, do it. All you have to do is promise to share these ideas with your colleagues at the various science fairs 3M holds every year. And the real power of 3M, they've got a, you know, a long list of their innovations like ScotchGuard that have come out of these 15%, you know, they call it the bootlegging hour. But the real message it sends is this message of attentional flexibility, attentional freedom, that their message to their employees is, look, we think you're smart, we trust you, that's why we hired you. We're not going to try to micromanage your mind. We're not going to tell you to always be at your desk looking productive. If you need to take a walk across campus, go for it. You need to take a nap. Take a nap. We're not going to judge you. Play some ping pong in the lobby. And I think that's a very powerful message to send to people in the innovation business.
As a university administrator, my blood pressure is going up just hearing you say those things. I'm just not liking this at all. One more question about the aha moments. I've always wondered. So certainly on these ones where you're scanning kids at scanners and you're looking for them to find Apple or whatever, you can see the aha moment. And you know that aha moment ends up being right.
Yeah.
But an interesting question is whether when that aha moment comes up, the kid doesn't say Apple.
Yeah.
They say bazooka, right? So they're wrong. Yeah. And I certainly know in my own field where I'm not creative at all and I never get these, but let's pretend I do, that I'm sitting there in the shower and I go, aha. And then after I work it through, it was wrong. So is there any correlation between the aha moment and actually being right?
Yeah.
Or is it just we have these feelings that maybe we did have a solution and then it turns out not to be.
Well, psychologists have this crafty way of not answering that question, which is they define a moment of insight as actually a solution, as a correct answer. But certainly you can disassociate the experience, the phenomenology of a moment of insight from the actual insight. And the clearest way to do this is to take LSD. You know, you take a hallucinogen.
We have so many at-home experiments for you guys to be doing.
Well, there actually is a scientist who is trying to do this experiment, but it turns out it's very tough to give undergrads acid. It turns out there are a lot of bureaucratic hoops to jump through. But he's got a serious scientific question, which is he wants to figure out, can you separate neurochemically the phenomenology, the experience of that aha moment from the actual genuine insight that solves the problem space? Because, of course, you take hallucinogen and you're full of, people are full of, you know, profound insights. You wake up in the morning and they're pretty banal. Sometimes. So he's interested in figuring out if you can separate these two things. But like I said, it's a work in progress. Yeah. But it's a great question.
I want to talk about espresso machines. So we had this external group come into USC where they were advising us because we're all about technology. And especially because we actually have a couple different campuses, how do we connect people? So we saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of Skyping, you know, things and stuff like that to bring people into the same room, even though they're in 20 different places and all that kind of stuff. And I raised the issue of, I thought a better approach would be to go just buy an espresso machine and stick it in a hallway, right? And then when I read your book, I realized, actually, that's not stupid. That actually, most of my ideas are stupid, so that's actually not stupid, but I'm actually really interested in the fact that, as you point out, creativity comes from people having collisions, bouncing ideas off each other, but there does actually seem to be, you put people in the same room to have those collisions, and that those collisions in Skype or wherever aren't as effective. And so there is something about us being social mammals and actually bouncing off each other locally.
We still need meat
really
space.
Doing something.
We still need meat space, three dimensions. And this to me was surprising, because of course you go back 15 years and futurists, you know, we have video chats and email, they're predicting the death of geography, that in this glittering age of technology, we no longer need to, you know, commute to the office or cram ourselves together into cities. You know, why pay the expensive rents, put up with bad public
schools?
Right,
or scientific meetings in Milan or wherever where I wouldn't have to go anymore.
We can get the same content.
I could sit at home.
Exactly.
Right?
Life would be so much more convenient.
Exactly.
Who wants
to go to Paris?
And yet, since the invention of these tools, the opposite has happened. That the returns on living in cities have increased. And my favorite factoids from an economist at Harvard is that since the invention of Skype, attendance at business conferences has nearly doubled. So even though in theory we have this tool which would allow us to get the same content remotely, we don't have to deal with taking off our shoes in the airport and our belts and airplane delays, taxis, none of that. We could just sit at home in our pajamas getting the exact same information. And yet we go to conferences more than ever because we know that we still need to meet in person, that there is no substitute for these analog interactions, for just pressing the flesh. And I think it really gets back to the fact that a lot of these tools, these online tools, what they're really great for is they make our lives more efficient. It's easier to find stuff through Google, and you know, I love these tools as much as the next person, but creativity is often about serendipity. It is about those random chats by the espresso machine, and that's why when you look at successful, innovative workspaces, they're often about getting those bumps, getting those random interactions, whether it's, you know, Steve Jobs insisting there be only two bathrooms in all of Pixar Studios because he wanted to make people mix, and if there's one place everyone has to go every day, it's the bathroom. So it's that, or it's, you know, one of my favorite case studies is Building 20 at MIT, the ugliest building on campus, covered in asbestos tiles, terrible ventilation, terrible heating, terrible air conditioning. And yet it's got this track record of innovation that is pretty unparalleled in terms of scientific workspaces, from Noam Chomsky to the invention of radar to, you know, the Tech Model Railroad Club, which helped invent hacker culture, invent cathode ray tubes. You go down the list, and it's astonishing what came out of Building 20. And when you talk to people who worked in that building before it was demolished, they talk about it's because the building made you bump into people. It was very horizontal. MIT, no one wanted to actually be there, so MIT just put everyone there who they couldn't find a place for. So they put the linguists next to the computer scientists, next to the acoustic engineers. That's where Bose came from, Building 20. Yeah. And so you had all these random interactions that jostle, and that's why Building 20 was such a creative space.
Wow. We're getting ready to call on you guys, so get your questions about ready and make them a lot better than mine. You talk a lot about how cities, because of these collisions, are these creative engines. I was wondering more about sort of creative cultures. You know, I've heard it said that certain countries are more creative than other countries. I don't know how one measures that, whether that's intellectual property, patent rights, or whatever. I mean, I don't know what that is. But have you been thinking about those kinds of things?
The cross-cultural data is really messy, in large part because, you know, creativity tests are, you know, culturally embedded, and it's tough to come up with universal standards of patent protection. So it's tough to even use patents, which are generally a pretty good metric of per capita innovation cross-culturally. But one way I tried to get at this question, which definitely interests me in the book, is by looking at so-called ages of excess genius. So sociologists have this wonderful phrase when they're trying to describe ancient Athens or Renaissance Florence or Elizabethan England, they call them ages of excess genius. And these are these sudden flourishings of talent where you don't just get one genius, you get a ton of geniuses living at the exact same time in the exact same zip code, basically. So you don't just get William Shakespeare, you get Christopher Marlowe and John Donne and Francis Bacon. The list is very, very intimidating. And for a long time, these flourishings were brushed aside as historical flukes, accidents, just random clottings of talent. But I do think in recent years, historians and sociologists have begun to see these patterns, these recurring themes that appear in all these ages of excess genius. So it's stuff like the expansion of education. So Shakespeare's father was a glover, signed his name with a mark, probably illiterate. Shakespeare was given Latin lessons by an Oxford-educated teacher at the age of 8. This is because of an educational reform passed by Queen Elizabeth. So Christopher Marlowe was given a full scholarship to Cambridge. So the pool of human capital was greatly expanded. You also see new methods in all these ages of sharing information. So Shakespeare benefited from the birth of the publishing industry, gave him access to all these stories that he could steal. So he could take this mediocre melodrama called Hamlet and reinvent it as the Hamlet we know and love. Yeah. So you see these kinds of themes. You also see a focus on intellectual property. So patents were actually invented by Queen Elizabeth. And for the first time, you could get wealthy, not just by inheriting land, but by inventing an idea, even a play. So those are some of the themes that you see again and again in the ages of excess genius. What interests me most is actually a comparison made by Bill James, the pioneer of sabermetrics, the brain behind Moneyball. And he points out, you look at America, 21st century America, we're actually living in an age of excess genius. It's just the geniuses we're pumping out are a very particular type. They're athletic geniuses. That we are remarkably good at just pumping out physical talent. So we export basketball players all over the world. They have to have rules in Japan about how many American baseball players you can have. We win the Olympics every 4 years. And he says, well, why are we so good at pumping out athletic geniuses? And he says, well, look at the pipeline. Yeah. We drive our kids to Little League and AYSO. We encourage them at a very young age. If they do well, they get their name in the newspaper. If they're really talented, they get to play against other talented kids. So there's a progression, and we encourage that too. And then we give them big scholarships at the high school level and the college level. And then we've trained professional sports teams to make very risky bets on unproven talent. So they're going to spend millions of dollars on a potential draft pick who may not pan out. But all that money is a motivating force. So it encourages kids to really invest in their talent to try to get good at baseball or basketball or football or whatever the sport is. And so here we have to apply some of those same lessons to literary talent, to painting talent, to engineering talent. We have to have that pipeline. We also have to, invest some money to encourage kids to really invest in their talent.
That's very interesting. And I think my take-home message from that is you need a certain person at a certain time in a certain culture that allows them to thrive. So essentially what you're telling me is I'm a latent genius. I just don't have the right environment for which, so it's everybody else's fault that I am not a genius. That's absolute. I love this.
You just need your Christopher Marlowe.
Exactly. Okay, so we got time for lots of questions. I see some hands up. Don't applaud. We're not done yet. Lots of questions. I see lots of hands up. This is fantastic.
Hi, is this on? Is this working? Okay. I am in awe of how much you have published in the last month and a half. This question is actually for both of you. The Iowa Writers Conference participants were studied recently. You may have heard about this.
No.
The study was expecting to find high levels of schizophrenia, but found high levels of depression.
Yeah.
I thought it would be interesting to ask you guys if you have any insight about that. Also, synesthesia, does it have any connection to that part of the temporal gyrus that's right behind your right ear?
The Ira Writers Workshop, I wasn't aware of a new study, but Nancy Andreasen has been studying the graduates of the Writers Workshop for several decades now, and what she's consistently found is just the result you described, that I think she went in assuming that these people would score higher on the schizophrenia spectrum, so they probably wouldn't have full-blown schizophrenia, but they'd be like schizotypal. But that's not what she's found at all. Instead, she found that these people are depressed. And in particular, depending on the graduating class, and this backs up the work of Kay Redfield Jamison, who has looked at the biographies of 19th century British poets, for instance, she's also found that depending on the class, depending on your pool, the likelihood of suffering from bipolar depression among these successful writers is anywhere between 8 and 40 times higher than the general population. So these are big differences. This is a really difficult subject to talk about, of course, because this is a brutal illness. This is an incredibly difficult thing to, you know, to suffer from. I always think of Robert Lowell, the amazing American poet, who he suffered from, you know, bipolar depression, and he's, you know, he believed this played a role in his poetry. He believed this made him a better writer, and he still took Valium. He was still desperate to make the illness go away. So this is an incredibly difficult subject, but in recent years, people like Andreasen and Riffle Jamison have begun speculating as to why this connection exists. And one of their hypotheses is that the brutal swings of the mental illness, those euphoric highs where you're just bubbling over with ideas and associations and you need to write them down, that's like the moment of insight phase. And then you get this very, very dismal low, sometimes a tragic low. But what scientists have found is that negative moods, so being a little bit sad, being a little bit melancholy, actually make it easier to focus, they make you more persistent, they make you more attentive. So in a sense, the natural swings to mental illness may echo the swings of creativity in the real world. You get these euphoric highs, in which case you just pour out these insights. Then you get this low phase where you're able to edit those insights until they make sense, until the prose or poetry is perfect. So that's one explanation as to why you may see these, I think, quite striking correlations among successful creative people in the real world and various forms of depression.
I had a question about the comments you made about metacognition. I was wondering, I'm thinking specifically about some studies that have shown that people are able to judge their performance almost as a function of their skill. So people with less skill are less able to judge their performance and tend to overrate their performance versus people who are skilled tend to underrate their own performance relative to their peers. If you could speak to that, about the comment you had made earlier about that kind of the aha moment where you feel like, yeah, I'm getting close to the answer and you're 85% to 90% likely to be there. Whether there's any work that's been done or any insight about what relationship exists between skill in that particular domain and the meta and the accuracy of the metacognition about having insight in that domain?
It's a great question. And just to be clear, it's the moment of insights where you go straight from freezing cold to burning hot. So when you need a moment of insight, you often have no feeling of knowing first. So there is no metacognitive sense that I'm getting closer to the answer. Just the answer pops into your head out of nowhere in the shower. In terms of feeling of knowing research, the classic work on this doesn't involve skill, and that's for, I think, probably the logistical reason that it's done on undergraduates and they have no skills to speak of. sorry, it's an unfair knock. But you're giving them just various creative puzzles. So these aren't things where you can train for them in advance, where you've got some expertise in them, you've put in your 10,000 hours of practice. These are just creative puzzles. Some are analytical and some require moments of insight. And so what they found is that on all these various analytical puzzles, some are like math problems, some are just brain teasers, problems that aren't required in one of those aha moments, that people have very good, you know, people are remarkably accurate at saying, yep, I can do this one. And then they can say, I'm getting closer, even though I'm not there yet, I'm getting closer. So it's a bit, when you talk to these scientists, they sometimes compare it to as if you're lost in a city, you have no idea where the destination is, and you just make these blind turns, and you've got this vague sense that, yep, this turn's taking me closer. It is a very mysterious mental talent we've got. And yet I think it is a crucial part of the creative process, because this is something creative people rely on all the time. They rely on their feelings of knowing. They rely on these judgments that tell them how they should be thinking. T.S. Eliot has this great quote about why some poets are better than others, and he dismisses the talent part of the equation. He says, what it's really about is good poets are conscious when they should be conscious and unconscious when they should be unconscious, and bad poets, they get it backwards. That in a sense, I think good poets are able to rely on these feelings of knowing to say, yep, I should focus, I should chug caffeine, I should, you know, take my Benzedrine in the case of W.H. Auden, I should find some way to make it easier to pay attention, whereas, you know, and then when they hit the wall, then they go for a walk in the Lake District. So they're able to effectively alternate between these two phases of creativity, and I think that gets back to, you know, the real-world utility of these feelings of knowing.
I'm a little afraid to offer this question up to the ravages of your wit, both of you, but I seem to remember years ago having read a purported study of microscopic sections of Einstein's brain, which reportedly showed an increased number of either dendrites or internuncial cells. My question, first of all, is that true at all? Do you have any knowledge of whether any analysis had ever been done of his brain? But more generally, is there anything known or even theorized about the anatomic correlates of creativity? Might there be increased dendrites in certain areas of the brain in among people that are more creative?
On the Einstein question, I have a vague recollection that there's two major cell types in the brain, neurons and glia. Glia are the support cells, neurons are neurons. That, in fact, what they found in a number of areas in Einstein's brain when they did the analysis was that he actually had more glia, actually, than in a lot of age match samples and things like that. And so that led to all my glia friends saying, look, see, it's all about support cells. It's not about neurons that are actually doing the signaling. You know, those correlations are tough to draw any sort of firm conclusions about. As to the question of at the level of sort of dendritic structure or neurons or glia and how that relates to creativity, I turn it over to my esteemed colleague to the left.
The short answer is we're not even close to getting to those kinds of questions yet, unfortunately, in part because it's difficult to take a highly successful creative person and say, can we have some slices of your cortex? Would you mind? So there are the obvious methodological problems. But I think even if you leave the brain aside, it is very difficult to figure out, to try to predict in advance based on someone's psychological profile, based on giving them an IQ test or a battery of personality tests, who's going to be an eminent creative achiever in the real world. You can give Bob Dylan and Pablo Picasso IQ tests, and they'll look pretty normal. They won't be smarter than the rest of us. You can give them a battery of personality tests, Myers-Briggs and all the rest. And once again, they'll look pretty normal. They may be a little bit more open to experience, but that's about it. So it's long been a mystery as to how you can predict in advance who's going to be a big real-world creative achiever. The glimmers we're getting right now are, you know, two things that I find particularly interesting are, one, this is the work of Jordan Grafman, who's now at the University of Toronto. And he found that people who are essentially distractible, they call it low latent inhibition, this is a type of person who, when the air conditioner turns on, they can't help but look up. When they're at a cocktail party, they're always eavesdropping on the conversations around them. It's very tough for them to narrow that spotlight and focus on the one conversation they're actually having.
Are you going to say something nice about me or not? Which is the way this is going?
Well, the punchline is very nice. So we see this, of course, as a liability because it makes it harder to focus. But what Grafman found is that these people are actually seven times more likely to be eminent creative achievers after they graduate from college. And his argument is that's because when you're distracted, well, the one caveat is it helps to have a moderately high IQ score. That's where the correlation really becomes strong. And what he argues is that when you're distractible, you're always looking for unexpected source of information. You're taking that idea over there and bringing it over here and combining them. Most of those combinations are going to be a waste of time, which is where intelligence pays dividends, because then you can get rid of those ideas quickly, throw them out of working memory. But if they're useful, they're going to be surprising. And so if you're in the creative business, it helps to always be distracted by unexpected source of information. So that's why distractibility seems to be one of these personality metrics, these cognitive tests you can give people that actually seem to predict who's actually going to succeed in the real world. The other thing I'm particularly interested in is this new work on grit, pioneered by Angela Duckworth, and what she's found in domain after domain, from 12-year-olds with the National Spelling Bee, to teachers at Teach for America, to graduates at the Wharton Business School, to people in the creative business too, is that the single most predictive variable of success, what explains the most variation in who's successful and who's not, is this personality, this character trait she calls grit, which is basically, are you single-minded about your goal, and is that a good goal? And number two, can you persist through the inevitable frustrations and failures along the way to that goal? So it's a very important character trait. It does determine a lot of success in the real world. And she likes to explain it by describing Woody Allen's description of creative success, which is 80% of it is just showing up. Well, grit is what allows you to show up again and again. That the larger lesson there is creativity is so difficult. It's such a hard thing to do. If it were easy, that idea would already exist. That it's inevitably going to involve lots of failure and frustration and draft after draft, the red pen on the page, the failed prototype, on down the line. That in order to make it through that process and come out with a success, you're going to need grit. And so that's why grit seems to be this essential component of not just creative success, but success in general.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about creativity as it relates to time of day. So, for example, Dolly Parton wakes up at 3 a.m. every morning, and she has written more of her top 10 hits in that time between 3 and 4 in the morning, in the stillness of the morning. And then sort of as a side question, is 9 to 5 broken? Mm-hmm. You know, that 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock hits, and I'm at my least creative.
There was a study that just came out last month, which I was sad because I wanted to put in the book, because it was such a clever study where they polled several hundred undergrads about if they're a night people or morning people. And then they gave them tests. If they're a night person, you know, they gave them at night and also wee hours in the morning before they had a cup of coffee. And what they found is that performance in all these creative tests, you did much, much better, sometimes 50% better, when they gave you the test at the time of day you were basically not awake, where you were at your groggiest. That there's a creative perk to grogginess. So the night people did the best at 7 in the morning, and the morning people did the best late at night. And this gets back to, I think, the paradox of attention, that it's harder for you to focus, you're more distracted, you're basically half asleep. So you're more likely to kind of daydream, you're less in control of your mind, you're paying a bit more attention to these thoughts bubbling up from your unconscious. That's obviously not great if you're trying to drive a car or take a chemistry exam, but if you're trying to solve a hard creative problem, that's actually a pretty useful state of mind. I happen to have some of my best ideas at like 6 in the morning, lying in bed, I'm half asleep, and I really, and I wish I was fully asleep, but that's where sometimes the answers come to me.
That's right. Okay, thank you.
If you were to design a creative workspace where you're kind of optimizing the number of creative problems that are solved per second, what would it look like? And would it depend on the kind of problems that are being solved? What kind of attributes would it have?
Well, you'd have some blue rooms and some red rooms. And I actually think the Pixar studio is a pretty interesting model. I got to spend some time at Pixar. And when you first visit Pixar, you see they've got 11 drinking holes on campus. So it's like, oh my God, a single malt whiskey bar. I want to work here. And this gorgeous gleaming cafeteria where the food is delicious. And you're like, this is a pleasure dome, a 24-hour gym. And you want to sign up. And then you spend a little more time than you realize it's actually a very intense and sometimes brutal work environment because it's full of criticism. They're relentlessly, iterative. They really, the mornings begin with what they call the shredding meeting, which is where they just tear the 3 seconds of footage on the day before apart. So you start to see the flip side of it. But there is this very interesting architecture to the building, which was largely designed by Steve Jobs. People there call it Steve's movie. The original design for the Pixar Studios was there'd be three separate buildings, one building for the computer scientists, one for the animators, one for everyone else, writers, directors, screenwriters, editors, and so on. Steve Jobs took one look at his plans and just said, this is a terrible idea, just tore them up. He insisted everyone be in the same building, so they actually had to maintain the original Del Monte canning factory. And then he realized, you know what, it's still not enough, because the success of Pixar would depend upon these computer scientists sharing information with the animators and vice versa. They'd really have to learn how to mix. So it wasn't enough to just put them in the same building. You need to force them to interact. So he carved out this big atrium space, started putting everything in the atrium. He put the gift store there and the coffee shop there and the cafeteria and the mailboxes. And he realized, you know what, even that's not enough, because you could build people this beautiful cafeteria, but the animators would still have lunch with the animators and so on. So instead, his big, bold stroke of genius was to only put two bathrooms in the entire studio and put those in the atrium. And at first, this is such a pain, because you have to walk 10 minutes every time you have to go to the bathroom. And people hated it. But now everyone has their bathroom epiphany story. They all talk about the great conversation they had while washing their hands or while on the way to the bathroom. So in a sense, I think, you know, the lessons of the Pixar Studio are try to maximize those collisions, even if they come with seemingly obvious trade-offs. You know, you don't want to spend a big percentage of your day commuting to the bathroom. And yet, I think what Jobs insisted on is that's a necessary trade-off. So that's I think, one big theme you see. You know, when in doubt, I think we don't have a much better model of human interaction than a crowded urban sidewalk. So when in doubt, imitate the city, I think, would be my general principle for office design.
And our last question.
Could you speak a little bit about the role, or if at all, there is a role of dyslexia in creativity, and perhaps, from what I've read anyways, that it shifts the brain somewhat to thinking more on the left side or a greater utilization of left side, hemisphere thinking?
Yeah. I'm not familiar with any work that looks directly at the hemispheric shift caused by dyslexia, but I think it's one of these, you know, disorders that we've, you know, in recent years come to see is it's got benefits too. So dyslexia, people with dyslexia tend to be better at visual gestalt processing. They're better at getting the gist of a picture very quickly. They also have better peripheral perception. So it's a disorder which is really about trade-offs, I think. It's about there are some pluses to it and then there are the obvious minuses. But I think it does reveal that you know, the human mind is a category buster. I think we're so eager to compartmentalize ourselves, to believe there's a clear, bright, sharp line between, you know, a mental disorder and a neurotypical mind, a normal mind. And I think what makes the human brain, these 3 pounds of meat, interesting to me is it blurs a lot of those distinctions. And so this is a theme you've seen in a lot of studies of so-called disorders of the mind in recent years. So, you know, we know there are these, you know, enhancements in visual processing with dyslexia. We found the same thing with ADHD. People with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they actually are more likely to be eminent real-world creative achievers too. So it's, again, that distractibility spectrum. People at the far end of the spectrum are also more likely to be, you know, actually do something interesting in the creative domain. This is part of a larger theme. Just last week, a study came out looking at people with autism, on the autism spectrum disorder, and it turns out they're better at information processing, that they can handle visual tasks that totally overwhelm the normal mind, and yet they can keep track of it. They can take all the information in and make sense of it. So I think we're starting to realize that the human mind is very, very interesting, that there are many different kinds of mind, and that's a good thing.
Just a couple more things before we break up. Once again, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Please
so
support
much.
Aloud. Please support the Library Foundation. What a great organization. You got to read this book. I think it's Latin for how creativity works, but it is by one of the great, one of the great writers of science of this generation. Please give it up. John Allaire.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.